Seldom do you come across economists who've seen the entire spectrum of transformation of Indian economy over decades. A friend from Oxford today, happy to have him on our program. Dr. Rajiv Kumar.
Hi, Silvan.
How wonderful to see you here, far away from Oxford.
How wonderful to see you here, far away.
Lovely, lovely. But tell me, how did you start from an outstanding school, schooling in Delhi, moving on to do a PhD from Lucknow University, and then Oxford at the same time as I was at Oxford? Yes. How does that journey take you to where you are today, and what are the great things that you have done en route to coming here?
I came to Delhi as a merit scholarship holder to Modern School from Lucknow, and then went on to St. Stephen's as economics honors student. For us, turbulent days, so I left St. Stephen's and found a sucker in Lucknow, where I went back to the university. I did my MA and PhD. And while I was enrolled finishing my PhD as an ICSSR Junior Research Fellowship, I got the first batch of the INLEC scholarship to go to Oxford. I must confess that I knew very little about Oxford. Didn't know anything about New College, where I was going
to. Where you were?
Where I was. But then found out that New College was 600 years old and was amazed at the fact that I had access to more than 40 libraries, and our college library was open day and night.
Do you remember New College? I am tempted to remind you of this. Do you remember the mint julep evenings in New College?
Yes, absolutely. The mint julep evenings, and they were incredible. And the entire college getting drunk was, you know, actually quite a sight. And then you would go from there to King's Arms after the mint julep dinner. So, and those were quite incredible days. And I actually wanted to stay on in Oxford, because even after my PhD, as a postdoctoral.
But we all do. We all do want to stay back at Oxford.
Yes, but my wife-to-be, who was studying at Sorbonne, she got her degree in 1982 and said, I'm going back to India. You decide for yourself. And of course, you know, the decision was, in a way taken. So I came back right back after I was awarded the degree. And by sheer chance, met up with Dr. K. Bilal, who had set up ICRIA year before, in 1981. My career began with a think tank. And after that, I went to IIFT, become a professor, then got into the government. First into the Bureau of Industrial Cost and Prices with Dr. Bijay Kelkar, and then appeared before the UPSC to be selected as the economic advisor to the Ministry of Finance.
And this is around 91.
This is around 91.
So the great moment of reform, etc.
And so I was very fortunate to have joined that team led by Dr. Manmohan Singh, and Montague was there as the economic secretary, economic affairs. Shankaracharya is the chief economic advisor. So I had an amazing team and an amazing agenda. So it was actually like being in the midst of making change, transforming.
Who was driving that energy from the top?
Of course, Montague, Dr. Manmohan Singh, but A.N. Verma in the Prime Minister's office. He was the one who really drove, in a very special way, and the sort of reforms, etc. And the energy came. So it was down the line, actually, from A.N. Verma and Dr. Manmohan Singh, Montague, and Rangarajan, who was the governor of the Reserve Bank.
So what was the moment that triggered this? Was the pressure of circumstances that caused it, or there was just a moment of sort of fresh thinking suddenly?
There was an acute crisis on the balance of payments in 1990. You remember there were several changes of prime ministers.
That's right.
Dr. Chandrasekhar, yeah, and then other, yeah, so on. And then even this was a minority government. And at that one point of time, India was almost defaulted on its external borrowing.
That's right.
So that the governor of the Reserve Bank, an IAS officer. He actually flew to London with a plane load of gold so that India didn't default on that loan. And there, our reserves were down to 2 weeks of our imports. And we just had to take action at that point of time. So that was the trigger moment. But, you know, but I do want to point out the fact that, you know, over the 80s, since Rajiv Gandhi had become the Prime Minister, there was a reform in the air. And there was a lot of work that we had done in ICRIA and other institutions had done, pointing to the need of reforms. One of the things that Dr. Vijay Kelkar and I wrote a report later on, and he insists until today that if that report had been published by the government of India, which it wasn't at that point of time, nobody would have ever said that these reforms were done under pressure from the IMF or the World Bank. These were self-generated reform because all the intellectual work had been done within the government and its allied think tanks and so on.
That's a very critical moment in what our economic life, yes, etc. And after years of the implications of reform and the outcomes of reform, we've now suddenly hit a rough pocket again. We've got an air pocket again, maybe quite different from 91. But do you think there are lessons of 91 and pre-91 that could be today called for, necessary? And how do you see the crisis that today is being imposed upon us? How do you see this?
You said it yourself, but crises of 1991 were in fact self-inflicted. The current situation has been externally imposed on us because of the West Asian conflict and the Straits of Hormuz and so on, and our energy vulnerability. What we can learn from 1991 is that this is the time for the whole of the government to come together and work with the allied academics, intellectuals, thinkers in a very non-partisan way to steer a way forward for the country. And what is critical here is, one, improve our energy security, reduce our vulnerability on the external account, and third, encourage and somehow get the private sector to invest much more.
Why we hear this again and again, that government spending is not enough, private investment is not coming, and private investment is not coming for what reason? If we have a generally a good profile and a strong economic profile, then why is the private sector so reluctant?
We have to, one, accept the fact that the private investor is not forthcoming, and even the external investor, the foreign investors, they've been taking money out, and our own investors are investing abroad or acquiring assets abroad. Mm-hmm. Second, then about the reason, I think it's the uncertainty is anathema to investment. Uncertainty means complete lack of probability, so you don't know what the outcome would be. And to that extent, that's...
But is that purely an economic issue, or this is a semi-economic, semi-political
issue? It's always a political economy issue. Mm-hmm. It's never a purely economic issue. Actually, there is no such thing as pure economics. Economics is all about political economy. In our country, unfortunately, our principal stakeholders, which are four, the government, the business, private sector, civil society, and the academia, we still, after 70 years, don't work on the basis of mutual trust. There is somehow, what you get is sort of mistrust among these principal stakeholders, so that everybody is, in a sense, out to catch the other person. Now, that doesn't work in a global situation where you have to compete so viciously with everybody else. Now, that trust has to be generated. And the basis of that trust must be the understanding that for centuries, for times immemorial, it is the private sector which has taken India forward.
So issues like ease of doing business, etc., those are the things that
you believe
are important.
Those are the things,
but
at the ground level and at the very micro level. Yeah. So you can't do this at the pan-India level. Which is something that, again, we are now working in this think tank, is that, each state of ours is very unique for itself. And so therefore, the ease of doing business, what you need to tackle would be very different in Maharashtra than what it is in Meghalaya.
Sure.
You know, so therefore, what you need to do is to bring these states on board in a very federal, sort of federated sort of manner, and work with them to see what can be done to increase the, you know, private investment, to raise the private investors' confidence in each one of those states.
The transformation of Planning Commission into Niti Aayog, the reform, if you like, or restructuring of Niti Aayog, and that's, you were there at a very critical moment. Was that in the right direction, or was it something that came too soon, and therefore we lost track of the planning that we could have done, etc.?
It came too late.
It came too late, yeah.
Because the Planning Commission had lost its, lost its raison d'être. After the 1980s, the Indian economy was private sector driven, and the planning was all about public sector investment. The other thing had, what had happened after the 1990s is that the Planning Commission became in charge of what was called the non-budgetary finance or the development finance, and that became very politicized. And the states would have to come and supplicate before the Planning Commission. And that was a kind of financial power that the Planning Commission have, which supposedly gave it the clout.
So taking that away from Niti Aayog didn't sort of take away Niti Aayog's clout? You mean you were just at an advisory body?
It took away the financial clout. Mm. But I mean, always I thought that Planning Commission and Niti Aayog, the clout would have to come from the ideas and the design of or the development blueprint. So the Niti Aayog, the way the Prime Minister visualized it and the way I worked with it is that to be a partner with the states, you know, to help them, to work together with them so that, you know, the sort of wrinkles between the central government and the state governments could be removed, could be ironed out. Idea of producing state-specific Niti Aayogs, which can then work together. And Niti Aayog was meant to, you know, identify the success stories and replicate them in other states. And, you know, and also get new ideas as to where India should be progressing or individual states should be going.
I'm reflecting upon your book called Modi and His Challenges.
Yes.
I think that was
2016.
You looked at those challenges from that vantage point. And now as you look back 10 years later, what is different that you see from what you had imagined at that time or assumed at that time, and what the outcomes you are?
I had pointed out there that, you know, India had was suffering from some severe deficits. For example, the infrastructure deficit, mm-hmm. you know, which was there, and, you know, or for that matter, the education or the skill deficit or the health deficit. Now, you know, many of these in the last decade have been tackled quite vigorously and quite successfully. So India today, in terms of its infrastructure, whether it's electricity generation or ports or railways or highways,
it's much better.
It's a
much
very different economy than what we've had in the past. What is still not changed enough is the education system. Although we have had a national education policy after 3 decades, and I think its implementation is being done, but ever so gradually, and I hope it will speed up as we go along. And the other big one that has happened was the Ayushman Bharat, the health, the National Health Authority. You know, where for the first time, the vulnerable segments of our population, the 500 million, you know, below the, you know, sort of in the lower income brackets, today have an health insurance, which is paid by the government. I think that deficit has been, you know, has been covered. So when I looked at 2016, was that book was more about Prime Minister Modi's experience in Gujarat. And there again, I had pointed this out, that while building physical infrastructure is necessary, you've got to build also the social infrastructure, which again has been done. Now the number of IIMs and the AIIMS and IITs is much larger. I think more than twice the number that were there 10 years ago. So I think the last 10 years have been actually quite an incredible decade, Salman.
But then your new book, the latest book,
yes.
Everything at Once, All at Once, etc. Now, how that transmit the story?
That's what the big difference that has happened is that in this book, Everything All at Once, I point out that the world has become a very different place in the last 10 years, which is that now we've got these 6 simultaneous transitions going on globally. The Pax Americana is not the same as it was in the post-Second World War. It's I would hazard to say it's on the decline. The geo-economic transition, all the institutions that you had created after the Second World War, WTO, UNCTAD, UNICEF, etc., have pretty much become dysfunctional. And even the UN, I mean, you know, they don't represent the 21st century reality in what the membership of the Security Council. So that transition is taking place quite vigorously. The third is, of course, the climate change. You know, and the window is closing very rapidly on us. The fourth, of course, is this new technological revolution, the AI, you know, which is really the fifth technological revolution after steam and electricity and so on. The rise of Asia. Let's remember that 1850, China and India together contributed to more than 40% of the global economy.
Yeah.
You know, and now that's happening again. Mm. So that along with Africa, you need to focus much more on Asia, Pacific and Africa than you would have to do on Europe and America. Finally, the rise of the global South, you know, which now contributes more to the globe. You know, so all these six transitions are happening together, and we in India have to address them and make sure that what we do to tackle these challenges is got to be, you know, done, you know, in a very different way than what we have so, you know, assumed so far.
That can be two ways. It can be driven at the top by the leaders in any country, any society, or there can be a kind of a renaissance in the country where collectively the entire country joins in a moment of discovery, in a moment of revolution, change, etc. What is the likely mode for us? What is likely to happen to us?
It cannot be but the change from the bottom up. It has to be the entire people together. Because, you know, we are not just a nation. You know, we are a continental economy. You know, we've got so many nations within ourselves, right? And so, and therefore, as I said earlier, each state being quite unique. In fact, in the Pehle India Foundation, we are actually working at the district level.
Pehle India Foundation being the
think tank that I founded
that
in 2013.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and what we are doing there is actually to start developing blueprints for the district level. Because in each district in India is on an average 3 million people. Salman, let's remember one thing. No other country in the world history had to grow exponentially and also reduce its carbon footprint at the same time. They all did the growth first and then retrofitted. We don't have that option.
Right, right.
And to be able to do that, therefore, requires, you know, a major, you know, transformation in our the way think, the way we look at, you know, our different problems, the way, for example, we look at urbanization or agriculture, you know, or highways, all of that, you know, because we'll have to do things very differently if we want to achieve both of them.
While this is work in progress, the perennial question there will be, if you were doing an action plan, where do we go from here? Where do we want to reach from here, etc.? There'll always be an elephant in the room, and that's China. We want good relations with China. We want good, friendly neighborhood in, as far as China is concerned. But there are obviously advantages that they have that we can't catch up with very quickly. But how do you find an adjustment and accommodation with China, particularly in terms of our economic interface?
There is no harm. In fact, it does a lot of good to accept that we can't compete with China, or we are not, and they are ahead of us. I say that simply to emphasize the point that this is the time to actually look towards China and seek and get whatever help or whatever assistance we can get in transforming our own economy. For example, if we can get dollops of Chinese investment to put up capacities here for manufacturing capacities for all the imports that we make from China, instead of importing them, if we can produce them here, I think that'll be...
Would they be willing? I mean, I think
they will be. I think they have been willing. In fact, they had invested.
So is it that we've been reluctant to allow investment? We've allowed trade, but we are reluctant.
Actually, that is right, and which is to me difficult to understand, actually, because you've got a $100 billion trade deficit with them. Keep the border issue separate from the economic issue, and the Chinese would accept that, and then go all out to get the Chinese technology, Chinese investment, you know, Chinese, all of, you know, into, and Chinese tourists in our country, because I think that will help.
As far as the people of India are concerned, I don't believe there's a problem. I mean, nobody, I can't see people objecting to Chinese investment coming, looking at Chinese factories or Chinese highways, etc. There's just been a reluctance for some reason that this is show that China becomes a bigger brother simply because they come and invest here.
You know, when I used to work in the Asian Development Bank, I had many Chinese, my friends, my compatriots and so on. And, you know, I was taken aback by one of their statements. They said, Rajiv, China has never taken anything from anywhere else except India. So they recognize India as the civilizational state from which they have taken something, you know, Buddhism.
Buddhism as well, yeah.
Now, so why I bring this up is to say that Chinese would be very reluctant to become big brothers for India. They know that they cannot be that. And they know that, you know, India is an entity, is a civilizational entity in its own right. And therefore, I don't think they'll be foolish enough to try and do that. Two countries together, I tell you, will make a huge difference to this global order and to the global economy.
There are many targets for enhancement of our trade with the US, with Europe, with other parts of the world. But one particularly of interest to our viewers will be the target that that Prime Minister Modi and President Putin have put to themselves, and that's of $100 billion by 2030 of trade between our two countries. Now, what is your take on that?
It's a target which is not just worth achieving, but must be achieved, because, you know, Russia, Indo-Russian trade has a long history. You know, we used to have something called the rupee-ruble trade.
Rupee-ruble trade, yes.
Which was a very special arrangement and in which at that time the Soviet Union in some sense helped us out of our own problems. And I think even today, Russia has come to our aid with, you know, availability of the discounted oil that we've imported from them. And given that we can continue to import fossil fuel from them, I think we need to ramp up our own exports to Russia. And I think it's an important trajectory to pursue as to which are the industries where we can export, increase our exports to Russia. And here, I think something that we have not thought about so far is agro exports, processed agro exports. And if, as I was mentioning, if we can shift away from chemical-based agriculture to organic or non-chemical agriculture and process them, I think there'll be a huge demand for them in Russia.
How does effort to increase your exports work in a world where everybody is trying to do the same thing? Is it that the world finds its own balance ultimately because there are some people who can't produce and some people who can produce and therefore they can export? When we talk about manufacture at home and increases manufacture, make in India, etc., surely it is to be able to produce for the whole world, not just for ourselves. Or is our market strong enough that we don't really rely on the world?
That myth has to be broken. We are a large country, large population, but we are not a large economy. So, you know, this whole notion about, you know, we are a large market, our market doesn't give you the scale to produce at world competitive level. So you have to export. You know, and you know, when you say that everybody is trying to do the same, you know, learn from our experience with the mobile phones. After all, in the last 5 years, and started, I dare say, in Niti Aayog, that the whole discussion with the company started, you know, and how to bring their production from China to India, etc. We are now exporting more than 3 billion, no, I'm not sure what the number is, but huge number,
yeah,
you know, of mobile telephones from here.
Right.
Now, how was that done? How was that achieved? Can be the model for all other sectors, but you can't possibly do it for every sector, you know, that you think about. So, which is why I talk about, you know, you got this production linked incentive scheme, you know, the PLI scheme, under which, you know, to begin with there were fewer sectors, but now there were 14.
Yeah.
What I would do is to select a few within that and then go out to the industry and say, what is it exactly that you need for us to be able to compete successfully in the world market? It all boils down to ease of doing business, Salman. And it all boils down to removing the cholesterol that is flowing in the sort of, you know, policy regulations and licensing and compliances, etc. And if we can do that, and if every state can be encouraged to do that on its own right, there is no reason for me to believe. I think that India will not succeed in increasing its share in the world markets.
Dr. Rajiv Kumar, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Salman. So wonderful to be here with you.